two of which are now living in Australia. So it was a big thing them coming over here. And all we'll go with Grandma, she knew Alan Turing, and unfortunately, we went to the other film. I wish they'd been here this evening and seen that. It was so well done. Did you feel it was well done? How did I get to Bletchley? Now, I gave a lot of thought to whether I should tell you this. I don't know. My mother and I were called up. Every woman in England was called up under the age of 50. And my mother was always the same as the year. So, of course, in 1939, she was 39. You see what a mathematician I am. That's probably what got me to Bletchley. And so we were called up. Now, I was called up to a place. There are a lot of English accents here tonight. I love hearing you. And where I was called up was 566 High Road, Chiswick. Oh, dead silence. Didn't anyone live in Chiswick? W4, there's a lady in a, is it pink or orange or coat? And that factory was making London buses, and when we got there, they were morphing into the body of a Halifax bomber. I couldn't imagine why I got there. Very strange. I did have my mathematics, so I suppose that perhaps was the reason. And then they were putting together the bodies of the Halifax. Eventually, this operation moved out to the Watford Bypass, a place called Leavesden. I'm dropping these names in case some of the English people would know where these places were. Now, depending on what the Halifax bomber was going to do, whether it was reconnaissance or submarine duty, there were different things. And there were a lot of Halifax bomber aerodromes on the east part of England. One aerodrome was Pocklington, just to tell you one of them. And it was my job to, if they had a crashed plane, we would get notice of what it was, and we would send back, have you got a such and such, which might mean that we could fly off one of the Halifaxes on the assembly line if we hadn't got that particular part. So that was sort of vaguely my job. Now, we found that a lot of this information was getting leaked from this factory in Chiswick. We had a board on the side of the wall, and the men were paid by the hour, whatever they were doing. They were sitting at tables making little gizmos that would go into a Halifax. Now, not all the Halifaxes had the same gizmos. It depended. So there was a lot of information there because they had a number on them. And if you knew what was installed on the Halifax, you might know where, which aerodrome that was going to, and it gave a lot of information. Well, this information was being leaked, and I was given the job. I was given 2 weeks to find out why this information was getting out. Well, of course, after the first week, I thought, I'm hopeless. I don't often think that. I think it more these days, because in those days when I was doing that, I had red hair. So I had to find out who was leaking the information as to what instrument was going into which aircraft, and we knew where that aircraft was going, which station, Air Force Station. Imagine the amount of information that gave. So it was important that we found out who was leaking it. And I had the 2 weeks to do it. The 1 week went by, I didn't do it. And my boss was very kind to me. We were both trying to work this out. And then my eye was taken by the timekeeper. Now then, I still remember his name, which will never, ever cross my lips, otherwise I'm in trouble. He's probably dead by now. The timekeeper was going round, taking these cards out and sitting at his desk and working out how much money would be paid to each man, depending on, you know, how many times he clocked his thing in. So I sort of, the second week I got sort of suspicious about this, because he didn't go straight from his desk to the rack on the wall where these cards were put. He would go to the rack on the wall, look at the cards, then he would go to the aircraft on the assembly line, go up the few steps, look inside the cockpit, see what was installed, memorize the number on the tail, and think of the amount. Can you work out the amount of information that gave? So I wrote a paper, which I've been taught to do at London University. I call it a paper, it sounds so important, doesn't it? So I wrote a paper, and I called it triangulation, because he was making a triangle when he should have been doing a straight line. Bingo, bless you. That's how I got there. And it was right in the middle of England and lovely countryside. And the gentleman who picked me up on the station was a man called Babbage. And I'm telling you this for a reason. He said, let's walk through the field, shall we? And I'll explain a few things. So we walked from Bletchley Station. We walked across quite a large field. And he was sort of giving me some sort of outline about Bletchley and said that my job was already there and I would be working with a very nice young man, but no flirting, he said. And I said, well, what's his name? And so he said, Alan. And I said, oh, I already have a friend called Alan. Well, he couldn't change it. It was Alan. So I got there, and this gentleman came out. We were all in huts, you know, all this, don't you? Round this big mansion. Everyone knows about the mansion these days. And they built these huts. I was in hut 6. But Alan, that time, was at the gatehouse. So, of the mansion, as the driveway came in. So I went in, and there was this man you've just seen on the screen. And he said, hello, what's your name? And so this man introduced me. He said, I like that, I like your name. I always wondered about my name because of my red hair, and my name is Olive. And Alan said, I like that name, it means peace. I can hear him saying that to me. So then we got to work, and my main thing was there were a lot of trestle tables along the wall, and all I did was sort papers. There I was, winning the war, sorting papers. But he was a very kind man, and I shall never forget him. This film was phenomenal. My husband would, I really enjoyed it. I think the other film, was disgusting. So probably the theatre manager of the other film would be sending a little registered note, and it will be a fine for putting down his film. Norman and I are about to go overseas, so we won't be in when he comes. Thank you. You know what he wants to say, and I've tried to stop him, obviously. He wants me to say, and I don't want to say, because I make it something fool of myself. He wants me to say any questions. And I might not have the answers. You might.
We can take a few questions later, but I just wanted to introduce Norman. He's in the audience. All of his cousins. He's avoiding the steps up, but 69 years. Paula has a story about how she kept up with Norman during the war, related to that plane parts project that you had where you're flying around England.
Oh, yeah.
You could drop in now and then on Norman. He was up in, what, Manchester?
Speak? Are there any, is there anyone from Lancashire here?
There you go.
One person, Norman, so you could be the one to ask him the question. Where in Lancashire do you come from?
Blackpool.
Oh, we could, my husband's house in Southport. If you went, I'm afraid it was the bathroom window. Sorry about that. But looking through the bathroom window, you could see Blackpool Tower. Yeah. Couldn't you? Yeah. Congratulations. Now that was an easy one, so I don't know. Something fool if I said any more.
There's a question here.
Oh dear, now what's this one?
What did you do after the war? What did you do with your career after the war?
Well, you know what women do with their careers.
Yeah, well, I'd like
to have three children. That's what happens to you.
This is actually a sort of side note. I read a book where they talk about Alan Turing and Babbage. In the computer machine, Goodell actually bought.
Yes, Mr. Babbage was the one who met me.
Okay, I read a book that had a. It's by Goodell Usher bought by Douglas R. Hofstadter, and they talk about Alan Turing in that book, the computers. And Douglas R. Hofstadter's dream was that somehow mathematical patterns actually give rise to the very nature of consciousness. Now, I read that book in my teens, and I also, the incident, I met Jesus Christ of Nazareth, and he's coming soon. I met the real one, but it's all secret, and there are saints in Victoria, and angels, and all sorts of stuff, but I just wanted to let you know that. Yeah.
The secret is out. There's a couple of things I was hoping to have you bring up or tell stories. One thing I meant to mention is Norman was training to be a physician. He's an eye surgeon. Was working in Victoria here, and he lived in Brentwood, and he was commuting in for emergency surgery at times from Brentwood. So they finally settled up in Ten Mile Point and stayed up there. So that was Norman's career. That he was trained during the war. And they married in 1946, and you came out in 1951 to Canada.
Yes, we. Oh dear, Canadians, I love you, except for one thing: British doctors. I don't know whether this is how it is now, but this was in 1951. Is there a doctor in the house, besides my husband? Because in 1951, if you emigrated to Canada from England with a medical degree, you were only allowed to go take a deep breath, the miserable provinces, like Saskatchewan, Alberta. And another one I've forgotten conveniently on the East Coast. We couldn't come to this beautiful city, this beautiful province. My husband, having done nothing but eye surgery in his career, then had to sit the whole medical degree again in order for us to be sitting in those two seats just there. Does that apply to anyone else with a different degree in the audience? I think that was discrimination. On the other hand, he's a jolly good doctor now. I'm not shouting for patience because he's retired and so on.
So it's Prince Albert?
Oh, I know what you want to. He must be a conservative, right?
Oh, this is an interesting connection.
Yeah, it is. When we went straight to Prince Albert, and this was arranged before we left England. This practice was needed another man. So my husband actually flew out to Canada and went to Prince Albert and met the doctor, and they arranged to get together. And then he came back for me. We lived in Richmond in Surrey then. The three of us came back together with my little boy, who was four then. I think he's past 65 now. And so we went to Prince Albert. And it's a very pretty, beautiful town, Prince Albert, because it has trees. Some places in Canada don't have trees, like Moose Jaw. Which is where we went next. We were 14 years in Moose Jaw. So there we were in Prince Albert, and one day I came home with the groceries, and a very nice man opened my garden gate for me. And he said, how are you getting on? He must have known that we'd come from Britain. And I said, oh, well, you know, it's very different. I had a little boy who arrived in little short trousers and a little blazer, which I had to change into jeans pretty damn quick. Mr. Stephen Bailey, I just sort of got to know. And one day he said to me, I have something to tell you. And he bent down, do you remember Mr. Stephen Bailey? And I said, what is it, Mr. Stephen Bailey? He said, I'm going to tell you something. Got hold of my arm. I'm getting married again. Well, that surprised me a bit. And I said, well, why is that? Well, she's very nice, he said. So I thought, well, I'd better be polite. Well, I almost said, well, do you know her name? He did know her name. And you people know her name. Olive, which is my name.
We'll do a couple of questions, but you have to hear this priceless story that I learned early on. First time I talked on the phone to Olive, she was talking about the gift that Alan gave to Joan.
I suppose in those days we were all romantic. And I actually did think, they went away for a holiday. I didn't know where it was it Brighton? I can't remember now where it was. Anyway, we thought that they got, perhaps it was Blackpool. Where's the Blackpool person? They were, it may have been Blackpool, I don't think it was. They came back and we were all looking for a ring on her finger. And there was no ring. And the box that he gave her was sort of rectangle and flat. And it was a fountain pen. So that was a bit of a downer. I didn't finish with a downer, but that was it.
I love that story because it just tells how close Olive was to Alan Turing and the whole scenario there. But it's talked about very grandly and wildly in the Imitation Game. It was a little bit quieter situation, and things were resolved without so much grandiosity in most situations, it sounds like, from my perspective. In the end of the Imagination Game, there's a scene where they put up the final credits telling what Alan Turing's fate was with the suicide and I guess the pardon, I think, is at the end there.
And all the medication he had.
Yeah. But they're shown outside after the war is over, after the job's over, sort of in front of a bonfire, throwing papers onto an open fire. And it seemed odd to me that these top secret papers would be just sort of floating in the wind and blowing around. You had a great story you told me. We were on our way down to CFAX. You were telling me this story, wondering if you should tell it. Well, we didn't get time to tell it, but maybe you could tell us tonight about how they disposed of the papers.
Yes. Actually, this held good throughout the diplomatic world, and probably still does. The papers that are used for working in any situation are really very... Look at those papers, they can hear me saying that. Some on the floor, that's the one. So you had to be very careful. We had sort of laundry, no, not laundry baskets, Safeways baskets, grocery trolley things. And so we went round collecting all the paper. We took it in turns. And this was at the mansion. You know what I mean when I say that, don't you? We went down in the lift. And even though we went down, as we got out, there was a sort of a corridor going across like that. Wonderful. You're about to get what? And the trolley went down here, and we used to, it was a slope down in the basement of the mansion, so we used to take rides on it. Secret baby. And I remember one day the door opened before the girl, other girl with you. You always did things in two for security reasons. And the other girl had gone ahead to open the door for me riding on this trolley, riding on this trolley. And the door opened and I shot through. At the same time, another door opened because quite opposite were the men's lavatories. And there I was in the laundry room. And I shot into a lot of very embarrassed, zip up your front quickly, men.
Job done.
Dickens, you!
Your question, please.
I had a chance to speak to Ren, who used to work over here on Victoria's side during World War II doing some decoding, because they used to do that here as well.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. And I wondered, if what she said that when they were working in the coding section, one person would get a portion of the code, another person would get another portion, and nobody really ever knew what the total message was, and that was part of keeping it top secret. And I wondered when you were at Bletchley if they had a similar system, or if you were actually working in the coding area, or if you just simply sorted papers.
What do you mean by simply sorted?
No, which were you sorting papers as a certain function of the coding? How was that work? How did that work?
Did you catch that all? She was saying that the decoding system was to have each area sort of separated so no one would know the whole story.
No, so, we didn't. That's somebody's imagination, I think.
And you say you were sorting papers. What does that mean? What papers and what was being sorted? What was your function?
Well, it depended. Often it depended whether it related to the Army or the Air Force or the Navy. When we got information in and we had to forward it to one of the three services, that would take a bit of sorting. And sometimes we received messages in other languages, and we had a language section, German, Hungarian speaking people, and that was a way of sorting papers. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, there was a lot of that. Actually, I read a book about Bletchley and this business about sorting papers. And apparently, at the end of the war, when everything was being demolished, they found a lot of the papers were stuffed around windows. Being English, you know, there'd be a horrible cold draft. So they didn't all go through the men's lavatories. Some of them were around windows.
But all of you were working right with the machines, like you mentioned Colossus.
Yeah. And, I'm not going to explain those machines to you, no way.
But you were working in the heart of the decoding
machine. Oh, yes, I was. Yes. And I had a thing about these red wires. I had some training in security, of course, working with one of the secret services, and everything seemed, you know, the phrase red tape. Well, you've seen pictures. Did we bring a picture of one of the machines? We didn't bring one.
You can see them online.
The wires sort of linking up that you would plug in on an Enigma machine. Well, an Enigma machine was too small. Colossus was one machine. And there's a lady sitting there blowing her nose, and she has a very nice red coat on. Now, if she... Yes! Could you show them that? That was the colour of the wires of the machines of Colossus. It really reminds me of them. That's the exact colour they were.
There's a very nice little interview if you look up Olive Bailey, CBC Radio. Who's the morning host these days? Gregor Craigie. If you look up an interview about a year and a half ago with Olive, that's when I first heard Olive's voice. She talks about working in Hut 6.
Yes.
And getting tired of running out in the cold weather with messages for the next hut over. You had a tube.
Oh, yes. I forgot to tell you that. Or have you already heard? It's probably common knowledge. I had gorgeous red hair. But one loses it. Not to a different colour always, as I see in the audience. Perhaps it's lost altogether. After we started, it was after I got there actually, they built another hut next to Hut 6, which was Hut 3. I don't know how they did this one. It was Hut 3. And being rather a junior, although my degree was equal to some of the others, but I suppose I was a bit younger or something, I had to take messages we got in Hut 6 to Hut 3, which was next door. And we all got fed up with going out in this English drizzly weather because your hair would frizz up. And it's not very fashionable to have frizzy hair. So we thought we'd have to do something. So we got the gardener, I think he was the gardener, to build a wooden, I can't really call it a tunnel, but it was a square sort of contraption from Hut 6 to Hut 3, because Hut 3 was where all the bigwigs were. So what we did, we had him build this square thing, and then we got a tea tray, a wooden tea tray, and you know the ones with the handles that are built into the wood? It was one of those. So we had rope on each of the handles. And when we wanted Hat 3 to wake up from their slumbers, we would rattle a wooden cooking spoon on the tray, at which they would haul in the tray, and it would go rattling along the... tunnel, and they would get their message, and that's how we won the war.
So, one more bone that I had to pick, that I picked up and my family picked up when we watched the Imitation Game on New Year's Eve, was there was suddenly, they came up with this sudden revelation that they broke the code, like instantly they could start understanding what was going on with the naval fleet, and suddenly they had a big map on the wall with all the boats, the submarines and the boats all marked out, and people had little sticks, they were pushing them around, as in one of these big charting tables you see in war rooms. I didn't think that could be going on in a decoding center. Other people were making decisions, and suddenly they realized they'd broken the code. Now they knew where the ships were and where the German U-boats were. Now they had to decide themselves what to do with this knowledge, whether to head off the ships, bomb the submarines, or send the ships in a different direction to save this young man who was amongst them, save his brother. It was a quick and easy way of telling the importance of the information, but I don't think you had a map on the wall in those huts.
No, we didn't have a map in any of the huts, as far as I remember. But of course, one of you people watching me would have a cousin in Kamisak or somewhere who knows there was a map on the wall. That's what you should never do on one of these talks. Never make a pronouncement that somewhere in Penticton someone will know the opposite.
But I think that speaks to your question about separation of information. You know, the decoders, some of these decoders would know a certain amount of information, they'd break a code, they wouldn't necessarily know what it meant, they'd send it to the people that could figure it out, and those decisions were made by politicians or the war ministry, not the people.
Well, I forgot to tell you about Churchill when you said about politicians. We didn't want him to come because he slowed us down. Behind Hut 6, where I was, there was a little mound of earth. You people from England, if you go back to England, have you ever been once without seeing a little mound of earth that somebody's left behind? Well, we had a mound of earth behind Hut 6, and after the Battle of Mattapan, Admiral Cunningham, that's a story I could tell. It's a wonderful story about that battle in the Mediterranean. Churchill actually did come down to Bletchley Park to thank Hut 8, the naval hut, and to thank the people in my Hut 6, we were Air Force. And all I can see it now as I talk to you. This drizzly, there is a poem and I'm not going to be able to remember it. This drizzly day, and there was Winston Churchill climbing up on this little mound of gravel. And we got out of the huts. There could only have been about 26 of us. And he stood and looked at us and he said, "It's absolutely stamped on my brain. I want to thank you all very much for all you have done." That's all he said.
I wanted to tell, or you told my son and I when we visited you, about when you were working for the aircraft company or aircraft project, how your life was saved during a bombing raid.
Oh, I forgot.
That's a pretty good story, and it's a miracle that you're here yourself with that story.
Oh, I forgot all about it. Actually, I don't know whether any of you have seen one of these things. I saw one in one of the war malls. There was a man with a little booth a few years ago, and he was selling name things made out of gold wire. The gold wire spelt your name. You see, I'm Olive, so it wrote Olive. And I had one of these in 1940, and there it was on my lapel, Olive, Now, when we had an air raid, I think there were a lot of British people here, and they know exactly what I'm going to say. When there was an air raid, we couldn't stop working, so we had this system. The siren would go. We would keep on working. We would go on with our typewriters. And we had what we called spotters up on the roof of buildings. And it wasn't until they saw the German planes coming towards us. The story I'm telling happened in Chiswick. And these spotters would then have a microphone and they would speak into it. Is there anyone from Britain who was there at that time in the audience? So, do you remember how they would say, take cover, take cover, take cover? Do you hear that? So we would get up from our typewriters or whatever, and we would go to the shelter. Well, this happened in Chiswick, 566 High Road, Chiswick, and everyone went. The aeroplane, you could hear the engine coming, was dropping its bombs, and all the people who had gone before us, I had this olive brooch on my lapel. It stuck in the typewriter keys, and I was held prisoner by it. And my friend Joyce said, for God's sake, I'll get rid of the thing, and she tore it, and it wouldn't come out. And we were both stuck there. And the bombs dropped, everyone was killed. Joyce and I were buried for 4 hours. And so the pin saved my life. Now, I told this story to the children at Glen Lyon School, and one little boy in grade 5 got up and said, Miss, Miss. And I thought, oh God, I've nearly finished this lecture. What does he want? He said, Miss, very politely, you are mistaken, he said. Imagine taking me off. It didn't save one life, it saved two. And it saved my friend's life, Joyce. And I heard from her the other day, well, it's just been Christmas. Oh. So we're both going strong.
So all of, you've kept everybody here. No more, hardly anyone has left, which is great. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you all. Thank you all.
Of what we did, and I know you're amongst the audience, may it never happen again. Yeah.